But still, it's kind of good to get some, like, a Buddhist perspective on desire, sensual desire, that how the Buddha looks upon this, and this makes sutta, it's all about that. And it's one of those sutta that I pretty much hear on every retreat, because it is very kind of crucial for understanding the sensual pleasures and things. So this sutta is, has a number of similes, and the similes can kind of illustrate the problem with sensuality. That's what this really is about. So, Purkalya Sutra. This is a man called Purkalya. He was wandering around with a stiff hand, kind of ostentatiously trying to pretend to be that he was an ascetic. The Buddha was saying that he's not really an ascetic because he hadn't really given up those things that are required to give up. To be considered an ascetic fully. And then he gets a bit upset and his pride is a bit hurt, and then they have this discussion. And then the Buddha explains the problem with his sensuality, that's the context here. And then the Buddha gives these seven similes to explain the problem with the sensual pleasures. So, this is what the first simile. Household. Suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was awakened by the butcher's shopper. Then the skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-matched, intact skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing it? Such a well-matched, intact skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton, well hacked, clean hacked, meatless bones, smeared with blood. Eventually that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, the noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So to understand this simile, the idea of sensual pleasures in Buddhism refers really to two different things. It refers to all the objects in the world that are considered pleasurable. Everything, everything we own and everything we enjoy in life, and all the objects that we enjoy, that's called sensual pleasures. And here, most of these similes are actually the objects that we're talking about. Sensual pleasure also means our perception of desire, and the desire for these things. That desire is also part of sensual pleasure. There are two sides to it. Usually, very often the suttas actually refers to the objects in the world that you attach to and you pray for. That is sensual, people call sensual pleasure. This particular simile, I think, is very powerful, illustrates very well the problem of the sensual pleasures. And the idea here of this dog going to the butcher shop, we actually discussed this simile earlier on, but let's do it again because it's a very nice simile. The idea of the dog going to the butcher shop and then sitting outside waiting for the for the meat or whatever to come. But the meat never comes because the butcher is not going to give good meat to a dog. So eventually when something gets chucked out, you're sitting outside looking out, looking into the window, which is not craving, it's very strong, because you're hungry and weak. That's what it says here. A dog overcome by anger and weakness. Then eventually a dog, a bone gets tossed out. There's no meat on it. There's no sustenance. There's nothing really to sustain you. All you have is a bit of blood. And you get kind of a taste, Get some idea of the taste, what this is like. No real satisfaction, no completion, no real ending to that craving. A tiny little kind of stop, and then kind of craving starts again straight away. This is kind of like the problem. And this is what sensual pleasures are, exactly what sensual pleasures are like. If you're a little bit of a craving stops for a short time, and you feel a little bit dull sometimes or whatever, nothing really happens, so, and then kind of it re-arises again afterwards. There's no completion there, there's no sense of satisfaction, there's no real fulfillment, so, and it can respond again later on. And of course, the dog runs off to the next butcher shop, yeah? The dog doesn't really learn, the dog doesn't get it, that butchers don't throw good meat to dogs. Doesn't understand that if the dog thinks it's a human being. That's what dogs think sometimes. They live in the family, they grow up in the family, and doesn't understand, never seen another dog. They think they're human. So, of course, humans, they carry away all the meat. Why should I be able to carry away some meat as well if the humans do not? It waits outside. You never get that meat. You never learn that you have to pay for the meat if you want to get it. And so it goes on and on and on, life after life, never really getting anywhere, never finding that thing. Every time it sits outside, craving says, yeah, when that meat comes, then I will be satisfied, then I will be happy. But then craving actually doesn't really understand. Craving has no wisdom. Craving doesn't realize that actually that satisfaction will never arrive in that way. This is what life is like, yeah? And it's good to note that little voice that comes with craving. It's not actually a voice, it's just a perception that we have that comes with craving and says, yeah, this will satisfy you. Yeah? And actually, it never does. This new relationship will satisfy you, yeah? You get rid of your old husband and wife or your old partner, and then this new relationship will be the right one. And it doesn't really work that way. And even if it is the right one, when you die, you still die, and then you kind of have to start again from scratch in the next life. But still, it doesn't really work out. So, on and on and on it goes. And this is the problem with craving. And it's very useful to notice that, because the more you notice that, the more insight you get into the limitations of samsaric existence. And of course, then the Buddha comes along. And what does the Buddha say? Well, that very sense of satisfaction that you are looking for, that sense of completion, that sense of ending the itch, ending the sense of emptiness inside, the sense of not being fulfilled, it can be found, but it has to be looked at, you have to look somewhere else, you're looking in the wrong place. That's what the Buddha said. If you always run after craving, it's just going to keep on renewing itself. You have to find that satisfaction inside. It's a psychological problem. There's a feeling of psychological lack, and that psychological lack can never be alleviated or stopped by external things outside of us. You have to work directly on the mind instead. That's what the Buddha is saying. How do you do that? How do you work directly on the mind? Well, this is what the spiritual path is all about, yeah? And this is one of the things that is so important to notice in your life. If you do an act of kindness, if you do an act of generosity, if you do something that is, a spiritual type of act, and you look at the happiness that comes from that, it has a completely different quality to it than the happiness that comes from the object of the world. The happiness that comes from the object of the world is always conjoined with craving. Craving is always around it somewhere. The happiness that comes from living the spiritual life, doing something which is kind, generous, etc. Actually, there's no craving associated with that. It is a happiness in the present moment. You feel happy now because it is something good. Nothing about the future, nothing about the past. And it stops craving rather than enhances it. So the more you build up the spiritual happiness, the more craving tends to die down. And of course, once you have that happiness in the present moment, you don't want to go anywhere else, because you have happiness now. And this is also how mindfulness comes about, yeah? Because you don't want to go anywhere else, because craving dies down, anger, ill will, all that also disappears as part of the craving problem. Then you find the true peace in the present moment. This is how you see how it works. It becomes very obvious after a while. This is the right path to achieving real contentment, real happiness. And then you build it up. And you build it up and build it up and build it up over time. You feel more and more content. You feel more and more. The mind is drawn into the present moment more and more powerfully over time. And then, of course, one day, eventually, you come to the point when you have the happiness of the present moment is so powerful. It's so all-encompassing. You don't need anything else. this is all you've got everything, and that's great. You can sing these songs, so, both for the past and for the future. And you thought for the first time in your life, you have complete satisfaction, complete contentment in the here and now. And you realize, this is what I've been looking for all along. This is it. Yeah. This is what Christ was promised me. This is what I was running after in my entire life. But now I found it. And once you get there, you actually feel like you found the answer to the meaning of life. That's what it feel like. Because there's nowhere more to go. The craving stops. There's nothing more to be done. Yeah. You have found the purpose of which craving was pointing to all along. This is what's going on here. This is the simile of the dawn and the kind of the reverse side of that simile, and what actually it is pointing to. There is no end to craving. There is no final satisfaction with craving. You have to look for the happiness somewhere else. Okay. First simile, very powerful and very useful to reflect on. This doesn't mean that you can throw out all your pleasures, worldly pleasures straight away, because you're going to suffer a lot if you do that. But it means that your mind starts to look for happiness also in other places. You find a more balanced approach in your life, and gradually you move more towards this other kind of happiness. This is, in large part, this has to do with what I would call right view or right outlook. You start to look at life in a more sensible way. And then things tend to follow along as a consequence. Okay, number two. Householder, suppose a vulture, a heron, or a hawk seized the piece of meat and flew away. And then vultures, herons, or hawks, or in other words, other ones, pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, householder, if that vulture, heron, or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable servant. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, for the danger in them is great. And here you have this idea of a piping of essential pleasures. Yeah? And one bird gets a piece of meat, all the other birds also want that piece of meat, because a piece of meat is hard to come by, especially in the animal world. So we fight over the sensual things in the world. I always hear about, we live in a monastery, it's not such a big problem, but when you talk to people, lay people, they always talk about office politics and the problems with kind of difficulties in the office, and always people trying to get ahead, people trying to get that promotion, and then because of that you get all kind of conflicts in the office as a consequence of that. It sounds terrible, I don't really know what it means because I've been there, but I can kind of imagine that. And it's terrible, and this comes precisely from this. Yeah? This is all about sensual pleasures. Trying to go ahead and get ahead is trying to get that promotion, trying to get a better salary. Yeah? All of these kind of things. That is what it is about, seeking for something higher. And again, one of those things about seeking promotion and seeking higher social status is very closely related to sensuality. Yeah? Seeking higher social status, there is no end to that, too. You get promoted, and then the next promotion will be for the next one. It kind of keeps on like that until, and it goes on and on and on. And it's never enough, because that craving, again, is never satisfied through that promotion, because it's a psychological problem. It will always be there unless you go to the root of the problem and solve the psychological issue. That is where the solution is. So status is never good enough. It's always just keeping on going more and more and more. And after once you recognize that, you stop seeking that status. And status doesn't actually matter anymore. It becomes kind of irrelevant. There's nothing wrong with having status. There's nothing wrong with any of these central players as such. What is wrong is how you relate to them. If you crave for it, if you want more. One of the strange things that I noticed in my life, some of the friends that I have are been very successful. And some of the most successful people are the people who don't really care about whether they get the promotion or not. They don't really care about money. Yeah,
they work their job because simply because they like their job and because they feel they're making a contribution or whatever. They don't strive so much to get ahead. And somehow what happens when you do that is that other people start to trust you. Yeah, and somehow that kind of seems to work really well for them, and they become very successful as a consequence. Some of the most successful people I know are people who actually are precisely very kind and caring and good people, basically good people, and who don't strive so much, but somehow that actually encourages others to promote them because everyone comes to them. So kindness works, yeah, if you do it in the right way. That's my experience in life anyway. I've never had any problems with that, seen many problems with that. Let's do it wisely. So you find all the things. We find all the partners in life, yeah? And once you finally get the husband and wife or partner, then you get afraid of losing them. That's the downside of that. You know, they might disappear, they might go off with someone else, they might die, whatever. Once you have one, you get afraid of disappearing. So there's always this fight, always this kind of conflict there with other people. And it starts when you're a child, just fighting over the toys perhaps, and with your siblings. And it goes on like that throughout our whole lives. And there's always a degree of underlying fear. One of the problems with getting wealthy, then you have to look after it all, and make sure nobody kind of steals it or takes it away. You get suspicious of your friends. Are they real friends? Or are they just people who want to share all my wealth or whatever? Yeah? It's endless. It's always problematic. And so this is one of those, I think, very kind of scary things about sexual pleasures, is that there's always a degree of conflict involved with sensuality. There's always a degree of problems with other people. Ill will always comes with sensuality. Where there is sensuality, there's also ill will and anger. The two cannot be completely separated. Yes, I say it's good to, you know, focus on the ill will side of things and try to overcome that. But in the end, you have to come back to sensuality, because that actually is often the root of ill will as well. Root of conflict, root of problems in this world. But ultimately, you have to come back to that. On the other hand, if you look at the pleasures that come through living the spiritual life, they are completely without conflict. There's no conflict possible there. Precisely because any act of spiritual happiness is an act which is good for others and for yourself. This is how I like to define an act that is truly Buddhist or spiritual. It's good for others and it's good for yourself. If you're generous, it's obviously good for others because you're giving them something, but also you feel good about it. If you're kind, it's good for others. It's also good for yourself. Yeah, it feels up. If you meditate in the right way, feels good, and you're kinder to others. Sensual pleasures is almost, sensual pleasures always involves a degree of greed. Yeah, that's why always there's a degree of conflict there. This is the difference between the two kinds of pleasure. There's a nice summary of this found in the Diga Nikaya 15, the Mahanidana Sutra, which is a long exposition of dependent origination. And it shows basically how, starting with desire and greed for sensual things, how stage by stage it leads to conflict and so on. Yeah, because of appropriation, because of ownership, because this is mine, and then conflicts arise from that. So this is straight from the sutra. What I say is taken from the sutra. So that is the conflict arising from sensual pleasures. Once you get this, yeah, you start to kind of realize that these things are inherent in these things. There is no such thing as a world that is entirely peaceful as long as we indulge in sensual pleasures. This is kind of, it's inherent to sensual pleasures. So it kind of puts you off these things a little bit once you get your mind around that. Okay, next simile. Householder, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man did not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder and noble disciple considers thus. sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So, grass torch, yana. And of course, the ember is blowing off, if you hold the nip in front of you, know, the ember is blowing off, coming back and burning you as a consequence. So, the grass torch has it. It has its advantages, and you can see where you walk in there. But it also has some very serious disadvantages. And it will burn you quickly afterwards, unless you let go. That is sensual pleasures for you. There is a degree of happiness for sensual pleasures. If there was no happiness for them, we wouldn't pursue them at all. So of course, there is some degree of happiness there. But there's also always the downside. And this is what this is pointing to. The downside, obviously, being greater, far greater here, than the upside there. Especially when there is an alternative, which is far better. So if there was an alternative, then of course sensual pleasures would probably be indulgent. But because there is an alternative, that is, you know, makes the difference. So why does it burn us in this way? And you can imagine here, the grass torch, you're holding on to it. The holding on is like attachment. Yeah, you're attached to these things. I own this. It is my relationship. This is my status, whatever it is. You hold on to these things in life. And because we hold on to them, because we grasp them, and then nature comes and rips it away. This is basically what happens. Yeah, when people die, when our possessions get lost, when we get demoted in the company, when we lose our money in our bank account or on the stock market or whatever it is, it is nature comes and claims back things that now nature's turn to kind of to show who's the real boss here. Nature is the boss in the end. And then, of course, this suffering. Why do you suffer? You suffer because you have attached it. Precisely because you're holding on to the grass torch. Let go of the grass torch. Torch falls to the ground. Once you let go, you can't be touched by those things anymore. So this is kind of the idea. As soon as you're attached to something, you are saying, please, may I suffer again. That's what you're saying. Now I want to suffer again. So we learn to gradually let go instead. And say, okay, enough of this suffering business. And then go in a different direction. And but remember, as I said before, you cannot choose just like that, when you're going to attach or not. Too often I hear Buddhist people saying, oh yeah, I should be a good Buddhist, I must not attach. You don't have a choice, you have to attach. Yeah? This is what the sense of self does. This is a very important thing to understand about the sense of self. Why is it that the sense of self makes it attached? And I have mentioned this briefly before, but I'll mention it again, because it's actually quite useful to understand. What is the sense of self? The sense of self is a sense of identity. You identify with certain things, yeah? I am this feeling inside of me. I am the one who acts in certain ways. You identify with certain things. That is what the sense of self is. And that identity often stretches out into the world, yeah? So that identity is at the very basic level, it's just consciousness and agency and all these kind of things. But it also stretches out into the world. A sense of identity is kind of supported by your relationship with other people, your status in the world, the things you own, and all of that. That becomes kind of an extension of that inner sense of self. So because it is an extension of the inner sense of self, if somebody threatens that, and it's going to maybe take away some of those things that you identify with, it is your very sense of self that is threatened. And that is why you can't let go. Yeah, this is why it's so difficult. So if so I should get the idea I'm talking about. So that is why the sense of self ultimately is the problem. Yeah, this is one of the reasons why Buddhism is so concerned about the sense of self and uprooting that delusion. Because once you uproot that delusion, you get a very different view of the world, and you're no longer attached to things in the same way. Yeah, so what does this mean in practice? What it means in practice is, again, like as you practice a spiritual path, your sense of self diminishes, gets less. It goes into fewer things in the world, because you start to see where true happiness lies, and you let go of certain things. As you do that, your sense of self diminishes, you hold on to less, you cling to fewer things. And as you do that, you're also less vulnerable in your life to suffering because of that. Yeah, so this is gradually how the path happens. And in the meantime, what we do also is that we learn to attach to things that actually are a bit more valuable to attach to. You attach a little bit to your precepts. You attach a little bit to being kind. Yeah, it's not a bad thing to attach kindness or attach generosity. You have attached to certain aspects in your personality that you value as being important. And then you can let go of some of the other aspects of your personality, those aspects that are more clingy, more holding on, more to do with desire, all of these kind of things. Then you move away from that and you attach to those good things. You attach a little bit to the suttas, to the word of the Buddha. You think, yeah, the Buddha is really cool. And you think the Buddha's cool, but the other stuff is not so cool anymore. Right? So then you think that, that's also a good thing to do. Right? So it's okay to attach a little bit to being a Buddhist. Yeah, attach a little bit to the Dhamma. Not too much, not so much that you argue with other people about it, but at least enough so that you aren't taking interest in these things. This is important in your life. And eventually you overcome these things completely then, as you practice in the right way. So that is the simile of the grass torch. And, yes. Okay. Next one. This next one is a really strong simile. And it goes as follows. Householder, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's eye, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him toward that charcoal pit. When he approached the householder, would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or deadly suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple, consider thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the best one. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit. Yeah, this is pretty hard to see. Yeah. That nice new car you got is a charcoal pit. Yeah. The beautiful BMW, wow, this car is so amazing. Charcoal pit. It's very hard to see, and you really have to kind of you have to look at things in a very different way to be able to see that. And one of the sutras that I always like to read out at this point, and I haven't actually added it here, and that is a sutra called the Markandeya Sutra, also in the Mantamanikaya, which gives a bit more flesh on the bones, yeah, to explain what this is about and how this actually works. And that is Mantamanikaya 75, I think it is Markandeya Sutra. And in that sutra, there is a wanderer called Markandeya. And Markandeya is a wanderer who indulges in the sensual pleasures. Yeah? His philosophy is that sensual pleasures are the highest, they are the best. Is it the real Nirvana or something like that? Kind of weird. I don't know how you end up becoming a wanderer to the golden one. It's kind of strange. I'm not sure how that works. But anyway. So, and then he had a discussion with the Buddha. Yeah? And they discussed about whether this is true or not. And then the Buddha comes up with his simile on the charcoal pit to explain how it works. And he said that it's just like a leper. Yeah, you know what leprosy is like? Leprosy is like you get all these sores over your body and they get infested and you get worms, all kind of terrible things. And sometimes, the fingers can kind of fall off because the sore gets so bad. And mostly in most fairly wealthy countries, there's not much leprosy around. But in poor countries like India, or at least parts of India, still can find lepers. And the Buddha said it was just like a leper. And the leper is very, very itchy. Yeah, all these sores are incredibly itchy. Because it is so itchy, and because you can kind of continuously kind of scratching yourself. And the Buddha says, it's like a leper who goes to a charcoal pit, or goes to a fire, and he burns his sores, burns his hand over that fire to get rid of the itch, because the itch is so terrible. And of course, when you do that, you actually get a measure of satisfaction because the itch disappears a little bit when you burn the stuff like that. And then the Buddha says, then later on, that leper goes to a physician, a doctor. The doctor is able to cure him of that leprosy. Yeah? He's now completely healthy, like everyone else. And he asks Magandhya, the Buddha asks Magandhya, would that leper go back to that charcoal pit and burn his hands again after he is healthy? Magandhya says, of course not. Yeah, it's crazy. Why not? Because it's terrible. It's very painful to burn your hands in a charcoal pit. And then the Buddha asks him the very question, is it only now that that charcoal pit is terrible, hot and burning? Or was it also so before, when that leper went burning his forehead? And Magandhya said, well, of course, it was always terribly hot and burning and painful. So what's going on then? And Magandhya said, well, before, his sense faculties were distorted. So even though the fire actually was hot, he perceived it as something pleasurable. Yeah, because of that leprosy, because of that terrible illness, where there's so much, there's incredible itching or whatever, you perceive what is actually painful, you perceive it as pleasurable. That is what is going on there. And then the Buddha said, well, that's exactly how it is with sensual pleasures. And that is why we compare with the charcoal pit. You perceive them as pleasurable, when in reality, there's actually a massive downside. There is also the downside of, you know, whatever comes with that sensual pleasure. Yeah, and this is kind of, it's pretty radical, and it's actually very hard to see that. And the only way you can see that is if you stand on a higher level, you kind of go beyond sensual pleasures for a while, and you go to something higher, and then you look down, and you can tell the difference, and you can understand this. You can begin to understand it through the simile, like the simile of the dog, the hungry dog. You can start to get an idea of why it is painful. It is painful because it's always agitated, it is always restless, it takes you out of the present moment, you're never really satisfied, always moving to something else, always moving to the future. Yeah, there's always something else that's occupying you. So you start to get the idea, and until one day you come fully into the present moment, and you start to see the bliss of mindfulness of the present moment instead. Then you understand for the first time. You have the bird's eye view, you can look down from a higher level and understand what's happening here. Charcoal pit. Yeah, so again, remember, the purpose of this simile is not to say, yes, I have faith in this or whatever. The purpose of simile is just to kind of open your mind a little bit to an alternative way of looking at reality. Looking at reality. You don't have to take this on board as absolutely true, but at least consider it. If the Buddha said these things, it actually is makes it very interesting. Because that's part of what it means to have confidence in the Buddha, and to take this thing seriously. So, that is the simile of the charcoal pit. And quite hard to grasp, but I think all of you probably can have some idea of what is going on there. Because it makes a little bit of sense, although not perhaps to be completely obvious. Anyway, next simile. Householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely farms, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing from it. So too, householder, noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, for the danger in them is great. And this simile, I think, is much easier to relate to than the other similes, which are perhaps more profound. And the idea that sensual pleasures, when we think about them, when we look at them, the dream, the idea of what they are like, is far better than the reality. And the dream is it the idea of it would give satisfaction to us, it actually gives something fundamentally, would change our outlook, but the reality is always very different. Yeah, you look at that car and you kind of crave for that nice car for many years, and then you get it after a few weeks, you're kind of fed up with the car, you want the next model already, you're ready for the next one. The reality is much more disappointing than the dream. It's all about dream. And I always think about myself, when I was kind of young, when I was in my when I went to university and all of these kind of things, and I had an idea about the future, yeah? When you're young, you're very conceited. You think that you're going to be the greatest thing, yeah? You're going to
what the greatest thing to happen. We have all this idea, I'm going to have this kind of girlfriend, I'm going to have this kind of house, I'm going to have this kind of job, I'm going to be very successful, you know, you have this kind of idea about the reality of the world. And of course, it turned out quite differently, yeah? And, you know, so it's just the thing, you have no idea what's going to happen. The reality and the dream, and it's such a waste of time dreaming about this stuff, because actually the reality is so different. But even if you don't end up out like me, still, that dream never really is fulfilled in the way you think it's going to be fulfilled. Yeah, okay, so you end up, you know, you have this idea about the kind of partner, and I'm going to have this kind of wife or husband. Actually end up with somebody quite different from what you thought you were going to have, because you have to settle for something that the dream is a dream of perfection. The reality is never that perfect. Yes, but kind of you reduce your expectations a little bit, yeah? And then you dream of something else, and again, it doesn't really work out, so you reduce the expectations a little bit. And while this is going on, suddenly you just die. Yeah, in the middle of the dream, in the middle of kind of moving towards something, you die. And on the other day, wow, why? What's the point? And you can really kind of confused, you're still kind of moving towards something that you never really achieved. And this is kind of what life is like. And then you get reborn in the next life. And again, you're dreaming, yeah? And you're going to get all of these things. And so it goes on and on and on, never actually getting anywhere, never finding any final solution. So look at those dreams, and just realize every time you get caught by craving, every time you see that nice car in the street, yeah? Sometimes you look in the street, sometimes you see this really fancy car, Ferrari driving by, you know? I don't know, I kind of like looking at nice cars, it kind of catches you for a second, yeah? And then you think, wait, what is this nonsense? But it's very easy to get caught by that. Notice that. And notice that dream and that unreality, which that is caught up with. Or a nice house, a nice home, it's exactly the same thing. And then it's a very nice learning experience. And all of these things, they help you, in the end, they help you to get into the present moment. Look at what's so nice about it. Sense of pleasure is one of the things that draws you out of the present, that reduces mindfulness so dramatically. And I think one of my favorite similes, which I've already talked about, that householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, and fine jeweled earrings, and proceeded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace, and people seeing him would say, "Sir, that is a rich man, that is how the rich enjoy their wealth." And the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much danger, while the despair, what a danger, endless is great. And again, I find this very powerful reflection, something you can reflect on a lot. And everything in life is borrowed goods. Everything has to go eventually. At the very latest, when you die, often a long time before that. Yeah, so and how much are you going to invest in all that borrowed stuff? If you rent an apartment, if you rent a car, how much investment are you going to make into that rented apartment? Yeah, you can be very limited because you know it's only for a short time there. How much are you going to invest into the things of this world when you know that on your deathbed you're going to have to let it all go? Very, very useful thing to remind ourselves of. And it's, you know, some of the things are very obvious. You're going to have to let go of all that possession. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. You're going to have to let go of all your friends and even family, obviously, and you die. Again, very obvious. You're going to have to let go of your body. Yeah, obviously. But as I say, also, you're going to have to let go of so many of your mental things as well. Because so much of our mental attachments are bound up with this world. Yeah, who are you? Your sense of identity is bound up with this world. Your relationships to your family, your status, your education, your anything you identify. Yeah, being a monk. Yeah, when I die, I'm not going to be a monk anymore. No. Yeah, I know. I don't think so anyway. So I think when you become a ghost, I don't think you have a role as a ghost. Maybe you do. I don't think so. No.
when suddenly, if you attach too much to being a monk, it's good to attach a little bit, otherwise it won't be a monk anymore, but not so much that when you eventually get there, you cannot feel the despair about this. So it's all part of our good, sir. And this is where I say that your investment strategy changes, sir. Yeah, you start to invest in that which actually lasts beyond this milestone. You don't put all your eggs in a basket that is temporary, and then the basket kind of disintegrates when you die there. And then when the basket, then all the eggs drop out and they all crash, and you have nothing left. So you get there, you do something else. You have a different basket, which is more solid, which lasts beyond this life. And you invest there, yeah? That is investing in the mind, investing in the spiritual life instead of investing in all the things that belong to this life. And remember, it is not, these things are not opposed to each other. It is not that either I invest in this life or I invest in the spiritual life. It's not as if you let go of everything that belongs to this life. These things can be done together. That is the main thing. So it is how you live that matters. Not so much what you do. You can do pretty much the same things. Maybe reduce or emphasize a little bit on certain things. But it's how you do that, those things that matter. And then you are on the right track. So remember, long-term investment strategy. If you want to learn about investment, come to the Buddha. The Buddha teaches you about investment. How to invest in the right way. And then, who ever thought about the Buddha as an investment and an analyst? That's kind of one nice way of looking at the Buddha. Number one, investment and analyst. Okay. So that is the simile of the four goods, and I think it's very useful to remember it. Remember, I was reading out this other sutra earlier on this retreat, but you were there, about this idea, everything that is dear and pleasing to me must become otherwise, must become separated from me. That's exactly the same idea as you're seeing here. Yeah? So again, very, very useful. To be thought about by a householder for 1.4, but a lot. And it says in a particular sutra. Okay, let's have a look at the last one of these ones. Householder, suppose there were a fence grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit. And he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of this fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then the second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove and saw that tree laden with fruit. Thereupon he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb the tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man went climb the tree, doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or his foot or some other part of his body that he might incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, the noble disciple considers us. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So, what is going on here? How does this work in terms of sensual pleasures? And I think the dense grove, this is like the sensual realm. The sensual realm is like you go to a city, which is all about enjoying yourself. You go to Paris, I don't know, Paris is often considered like the sensual mecca of the world. You go to Paris, you walk around from different restaurants, and you go to all these designer shops, and you kind of enjoy. The French are always considered kind of people who enjoy life, That's kind of what French people are supposed to be like. So, go to Paris, sir. Have you ever been to Paris, sir?
No? Okay, whatever. But Paris, you can look it up on the internet if you haven't been there. And I've been to Paris actually because I used to live in that part of the world. So you enter this town and you walk around, looking around all the shops, looking around all the restaurants, yeah? And you're kind of you're very enticed by all of this. So. And so it's probably similar to walking around downtown KL probably. Yeah. And as you do this, then you decide to take up certain sensual pleasures and certain things that you enjoy, yeah? You enter a department store, you enter a restaurant, or you enter a cafe to have a date with somebody, or whatever it is. And that is kind of when you attach to something, you climb that tree, you look at this, wow, look at all the mangoes under the tree here. What a wonderful thing it is. So you climb up the tree here, and you climb up the tree, of course, you attach, yeah? If you don't attach while you're climbing, you're going to fall down very quickly. So you attach to the bit, hold on there. And then you kind of get up to the mangoes, and you start eating the mangoes on top of the tree. And of course, mangoes, if they are just ripe, they are so nice. Everyone likes mangoes, they like them. Anyone here doesn't like mangoes? Everyone likes mangoes. I've never met anyone who doesn't like mangoes. It's kind of a universal thing everywhere. Mangoes and ice cream, pretty much everyone one likes. Actually, who would have even liked ice cream recently? Yeah. Anyway, so you climb that tree and then you indulge. Yeah, there's a kind of nature of sensual pleasure. If you go to Paris, you indulge. You indulge. You do all these kind of one nice things that seem so nice on the surface, but everything is so beautiful. Sitting up there, and while you're sitting up in that tree, indulging, what does indulgence do? It makes you heedless. Yeah, when you are really indulging, you forget about the reality of things. And this is kind of the point of so many of these similes, to bring you back to reality about sensual pleasures. But while you are in the middle of indulging, you forget about the reality of this. When you forget about the reality, you start doing crazy things. You start doing things which goes against the princess, because your mind is distorted. You're no longer seeing the reality. It's like a charcoal pit. You're burning yourself. You don't know what's going on. And as a consequence of that, and this is the problem with intoxication. Intoxication always leads to bad conduct because you have no clarity anymore. And clarity comes from drinking alcohol. It comes from, we saw this other sutta at the beginning of the retreat about not reflecting on death for all days. It comes from that. It also comes from indulging too much in sensual pleasures. There are so many sources for being intoxicated. Drinking alcohol obviously is a very powerful one, has a very strong effect. But all of these things are part of that. So you're sitting in that tree, indulging in mangoes, yeah? You can see why people might indulge in a nice, beautiful mango. And then, while you are indulging, someone comes up the roof, starts cutting down the tree, yeah? Yeah? And the idea here, because you are heedless, because you don't know what's going on, you have no idea that someone is cutting down the tree. You have no idea that death is approaching, old age is approaching, yeah? It's coming closer and closer to you. But you think, yeah, forget about that, wait, I'm enjoying myself now, I haven't got time for all that. I don't want too much reality, yeah? Too much reality is a pain. I want to live in a fantasy world. But. So you keep on practicing, indulging in these things. Eventually, if you keep on indulging too much, the trees come crashing down. And suddenly, oh, wait, this wasn't supposed to happen. Yeah, and then you are on your deathbed, and it's too late to do anything about it, and you have had it. You are, you look at your life and you think, wow, I didn't spend my life very well. Yeah, and then when you haven't spent your life very well, you kind of regret having lost the opportunity. That is a simile of the fruit creature. So what is the opposite of this? And the opposite of this is a very nice simile found in the suttas. And also spoken of by Adam Brahm in his book Open the Door of the Heart. And I think the simile in the sutta is the two friends, they're going through the grove, they're going through the jungle. This is like the grove of the forest. Everything is sensuality around them. And as they are going through that grove, through the jungle, they come to a hill or a mountain. When they come to this hill or the mountain, one friend says to the other one, and they're coming together, come with me, let's go to the top of the mountain, yeah? And I'll show you, when you come to the top of the mountain, you get this view, yeah?
You see the world, you see something completely different when you're on top of the mountain. You see the field, you see all this kind of stuff. And this other friend said, no, you go, I don't believe that kind of stuff. So he goes up to the mountain, this one friend, and when he gets up there, he looks out. And what does he see? He sees all the fields, he sees far away because it's high up down. He gets an overview of what is going on there. And he shouts down to his friend, I told you, you can see all these things up here, yeah? And the friend of the Buddha still doesn't believe him. This is right, yeah? You have the Buddha. The Buddha says, I have done all of this, I have seen reality, I've been to the top of the mountain, I understand how it all fits together. And we say, yeah, yeah, whatever, Buddha, you know, you do your own thing, I'm going to carry on in the sensual realm, yeah? This is how it often is. Otherwise, everybody would be Buddhists. But that's not the case. Very few people are Buddhists. And even fewer are sincere Buddhists. So he goes down on the mountain, he grabs his friend by the arm, yeah? Grabs him by the arm. Okay, come with me, I'll show you. Drags him up to the mountain, his other friend is still very reluctant to come along, yeah? And he said, okay, look! And what do you see? Oh, I see field, I see all these things, yeah? I told you so, why are you kind of, why were you in denial? And then he says, well, I was in denial because this mountain itself was blocking the view. Yeah, what is that mountain that was blocking the view? The mountain is a symbol of the five hindrances, for the defilements. The defilements block our ability of seeing what is actually there. Once you transcend those defilements, you put them beneath you, then you can see the view. You are above it all. You can look down, you can understand the jungle, understand the villages, understand the fields. You have a bird's eye view, you know how the world actually works. It's a really nice symbol here. You need to go above. And this is like entering samadhi. Yeah? When you enter samadhi, what you're doing is that you're gradually letting go of the mountain of defilement, the mountain of sensuality. And one day, your mind ascends, goes up to a height that you have never been before. And then from that height, for the first time, is it possible to understand what sensual pleasures really are about. Now you know, because you have a lot of over. Only when you have let go of these things, is it possible to understand what they are. Before that, you can't really understand it. Above, you look down, then you see. Now you understand why it is a problem. Now you understand where real happiness is to be found. Yeah, and that is how it goes. And it's very similar to the story of Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm had this nice story, and I suspect maybe he had this sutta at the back of his mind, I'm not sure, because it's so similar. Ajahn Brahm has a story when he went to Central America, you know that nice story? Yeah, it's a nice story. He went to Central America, and this was while he was at Cambridge University, I think. He was at another great adventure, he traveled all over the world, always by himself, just traveling around the world. This was back in the 1960s or 70s, early 70s. And the world was much more safer then than it was now. Now he's a little bit more concerned about traveling sometimes. But yesterday, they wouldn't even let me walk by myself. I said, walk, it's no, I cannot walk by myself. It might be easier, it might be It was very kind, I really appreciate the kind gesture, but I know they only look kind of confident, but very nice. But anyway, Ajahn Brahm travels to Central America, I've never been over there before. Yeah, this is Guatemala, you know, you know your map, you have USA and then Mexico, and the USA and under Mexico you have Guatemala. And Guatemala is very famous for these ancient pyramids. The Mayan civilization existed there, you know, 1,000 years ago, whatever it is. And these Mayans, they built pyramids. And so Ajahn Brahm wanted to see them. This was before they were very well protected. Everything was very open. Yeah, this was before kind of the modern tourist area had really started and all of this. So Guatemala, whole jungle, especially that part of Guatemala. So Ajahn Brahm travels on these lorries, yeah, this rickety old lorry that built Guatemala in the 1970s. I don't know, it was a bit dodgy perhaps. Yeah, so there was a lorry, as you see, sometimes you see it, actually in Indonesia as well, recently as well. One lorry, and then the amount of parcels on the back was about 5 meters high. It was like, whoa! And then three guys were sitting on top of that, yeah, while the lorry was driving the traffic. Wow, it looks so scary. It's like hoping you could fall down any time. This was Ajahn Brahm in Guatemala, I know that. He's kind of big lorry, and he was sitting on top there, holding on for dear life on this top of things. going through the jungle, you never see very far, because the jungle in this area is very tense, yeah? I went walking with a hobby the other day in a small area of jungle here, and there too was pretty dense, yeah? It's quite dense when you get into the jungle. You can't see very far there. And so you go through this windy road, and you go onto the river, and you travel by boat on the river, and eventually you get to this pyramid. So you can never see it more than a few meters around you. And then you get to the pyramid, and you walk up the pyramid. And then for the first time in Delhi, traveling through the jungle, you actually go above the canopy, above the trees. And for the first time, you can see the horizon. You can see far away. And these pyramids were used for religious purposes in those days. The idea is that, you know, you extract yourself from the ordinary world, you get a larger view, and it's similar to religion. The idea of religion is also to extract yourself from ordinary existence, you get a larger view. And quite likely, this would have been like a religious experience to these people. When you were young, taken to the top of this pyramid for the first time, wow! This is what the world looked like. All I've ever seen in my whole life is trees, yeah? I've never seen further than 5 meters away. Now I can see what the world is like. Yeah? Maybe it's very similar to the religious experience you have in Samadhi, yeah? Except that it is much, much more powerful, obviously. Yeah? But it's a similar kind of idea. You get above it all. You can see out. You can see far away. You see things in perspective. You understand how all of these elements, how they relate to each other. Yeah? So very powerful symbolism with a lot of meaning in them. So that is the simile of the dense grove with fruit, yeah, in search of fruit, in search of mangoes, perhaps. And then this is what happens. This is the problem with sensual pleasures. So that is a few sutras. One sutra we did on sensual pleasures. And still have a bit more time now, so I can talk a bit more about sensual pleasures if you like. One of the sutras that often also we have at this particular retreats like this. This is a sutra from the Sanyuga Nikaya. The Sanyuga Nikaya is actually quite nice. And if you want to read some nice sutras that are kind of inspiring and enticing, and you know, they have a big verse about spoken by the Deva and the Buddha often replies it. And often they're very short, often quite inspiring. I really recommend you to have a read of the Sanyutta Nikaya, especially the first book of the Sanyutta Nikaya is called the Sagatavaka. Gata in Pali means verse. This means like the Sagana means the chapter of sutta that are with verse. Sa means with, Gata means verse, so with verse. So they're all versified, and that kind of inspiring you to the sutras in there. One of these sutras, which I always like to read out, is the Samhiti Sutta. Samhiti, Samhiti Sutta. You can see it in there. It's pretty cool. Cool little sutra.
S-A-M.
S-A-M-I-D-D-H-I. Samhiti Sutta. Samhiti was a monk. And he was in that place. He was living in Rajagaha. Yeah. Those of you who have been to India know what Rajagaha is like. And in Rajagaha, there is one place that is called the hot springs of Rajagaha. The hot springs are at the base of a mountain, the base of a large hill. Yeah? And I can't remember the name of that hill right now. Big barn or something like that. And this is one of the very interesting things about India. Yeah? When you go to India, it's like stepping back into the sutras almost. So now, you know, at that time in ancient India, people would go to these hot springs and they would bathe. Yeah. And they would wash themselves, and the monks would go there. The king would even go there, according to the Sanskrit. And the kings are pretty ordinary people, though, that they're pretty kind of low key. They weren't really, but today the king is like really far away. In those days, quite part of the people. So, you know, people would go there and they would bathe there. They would come out afterwards, nice and clean. And if you go to India today, to exactly the same place, guess what is happening at that place? Exactly the same thing, yeah? People are still bathing in those hot springs that have been out for years. Nothing has changed again in India. It's still exactly the same happening here. This is kind of nice about India, like going back to history sometimes, just stepping back into existence. And the Rajagaha is actually very well described, and the Sutta is described as the hill fortress. And you can see why it's called the hill fortress when you go there, because there's hills all the way around there. And in the middle of like a flat area where you can kind of have your city, and it's very easy to defend, yeah, because of all the hills around it. So, and you can go to the Vulture's Peak, you go to Bimbisara's prison there. You know Bimbisara's prison, yeah? Bimbisara was jailed by Ajatasattu, his son, because he was influenced by Devadatta. Devadatta said to Ajatasattu, well, I will take over the Sangha, and he will take over the kingdom of your father, yeah? And Ajatasattu was listening to Devadatta, and he imprisoned his father, and eventually killed his own father. Yeah, it's a very bad karma, very bad idea to kill your own parents. So, the prison of Bimbisara's prison is there. Jivaka's mango grove is there, yeah? Mango groves were famous already in those days. And many other parts as well of found in the suttas, I can still go there and find them in the present day. Yeah? But the hot springs, this is where Samiti was. This monk was there in Rajagaha, and he was going to the hot springs, and he was having a bath, yeah, like many people would have. And he was alone there, and he kind of had his bath, was coming out, standing in the robe, and kind of drying himself or whatever. And as he was doing that, this Devata comes to him. Yeah, and this Devata, you know, very beautiful Devata. It doesn't say whether it was a male or female, it probably doesn't matter so much, but it kind of fits the story if it was a female Devata. And this Devata says to him, you are young. Yeah, you sit in the prime of life. You should enjoy sensual pleasures. You're wasting your time being a monk. Yeah, sensual pleasures, they are visible here and now. You can have them now. But you are searching for this goal, this nirvana. You don't even know what nirvana is. It's kind of far away in the future. Yeah, get out of those roles and enjoy life. It is like tempter figure, yeah, it's some temptation. Maybe it's probably just in his mind, yeah. It may not be any real favor, but it's maybe just in his mind. You understand what is going on there. Yeah? And then Samiti, maybe he's come in his mind, you have the angel and the devil in his mind arguing with each other, yeah. Maybe. And then the angel side says, no, you're wrong, yeah. Yeah, the sensual pleasures are not actually available here and now. Sensual pleasures, they are what is in the future. Yeah, it's the Dhamma that is in the present moment. And then the Devata is completely confounded. Just understand what he's talking about. What do you mean? I don't understand what he's saying. Sensual pleasures are what I hear now. It's obvious. Yeah, you can just go and enjoy yourself. And then Samiti says, well, I will go and ask the Buddha about this, the Blessed One about this, to find the answer. Yeah, and then eventually he goes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha about this, and the Buddha says a verse about how this works. I can't remember the exact meaning of the verse. But it's very interesting altogether because it seems like the Devata is right. Yeah. If I were to ask you, what would you say? Who's right? The Devata or Samiti? Who's right? What is actually visible here now? Is it the sensual pleasures? Or is it the Dhamma? The kind of the results of the practice that are visible here now. And because we're all good Buddhists, we probably said the Dhamma, but it feels a bit like it is the sensual pleasures, yeah. You can just go and eat, you can just go and have fun and enjoy yourself, yeah. Right here, it's sensual pleasures. Nice apple juice, yeah. Very accessible. Right there. Okay, let me explain myself. So it kind of seems right. And I remember I was teaching this because I go to Indonesia every year on this kind of tour of Indonesia, which is really kind of interesting as well. And I was going to a place called Balikpapan, you know Balikpapan, Borneo. And it is under the plank, I think, or something like that in Malay, under the plank, Balikpapan, that's the name of the city. A very charming little city on Borneo. And I was there, and it was a large crowd because they're not used to getting monks. So when they get monks, they're like, wow, we have a monk coming here. So everybody comes, yeah, it's a large crowd. So, and I was telling this story, and there was a young man on the front bench, and they said, well, do you think he's right? And he said, yeah, because everybody is right, but they're not right. Yeah. Because that's what it sounds like. It's very counterintuitive that the Dhamma actually is present here and now. But when you think about it carefully, you know that Samiti actually was right. Why is that? And he was right because craving sensual desire always involved with craving, and craving is always about the future. It's always moving on towards something else. It is very rare that you are satisfied in the world of sensual pleasures. It's always a future thing, the prospect of something more, the prospect of going somewhere else. It's a future thing, yeah? And so even that apple juice, yeah, you have a sip, and then before you know it, you're on to something else, yeah, and some other craving arising. And even while you're drinking it, you're already thinking about the next thing you're going to have, yeah, and where you're going to go next. So it can on and on and on, never really satisfied at the present moment. But the Dhamma, if you practice the Dhamma in the right way, yeah, if you are kind now, if you, you know, do something kind to the person sitting next to you at this very moment, yeah, if you say something kind, if you even have a kind thought about the people around you, wherever you are, whatever it is that you do in the present moment, straight away you'll have results from that. If it comes from your heart and you really are kind to someone else, you feel good right here, right now. And there's no craving involved with that. It has a positive effect right in the present moment. That is how the Dhamma is here in the present moment. If you are allowed to get angry with something, but you reject that anger using the methods that we talked about before, or you reject the sensual thought using some of the perception we're looking at today, straight away you feel the benefit of that. It is right there in the present moment. It's got nothing to do with craving, nothing to do with going into the future. It is present right here and now. So this is the meaning of this thing. But again, you have to think about it carefully. Only when you think about it carefully does it actually come out right. It is a bit counterintuitive. And this, of course, is why the vast majority of people in the world never really get the Dhamma, never really understand it, precisely because you need to think in a different way. You need to look at the world in a new way. And then it starts to come together. But once you get it, it's actually quite obvious. Yeah, it's not that hard to see, so that it takes a little bit of investment into how we think about things, and then it kind of comes together. Yes, sir.
Let's say if you're contented, does it mean that you are less craving or that you're craving involved?
Yes. Yeah. So the question is just for the camera: if you are contented, does that mean that you're less craving? Yes. That is kind of the meaning of contentment. Yeah, that there is no craving there. So contentment means this is good enough. Yeah, this is fine then. And this is why this is actually a very nice thing to say. People say, how are you or something like that. Good enough, because good enough means contentment. Yeah, not perfect, not bad, but you're satisfied whatever is there. Being satisfied with things where they are is always being contented, not craving there. Yeah? There's a nice little simile in the suttas which talks about contentment. And that is a simile of which we said that it's like a bird with the wings that is only burden. Yeah, the bird flies around with the wings that is only burden. In the same way, if you are a monastic, you have your bow and rod as an only burden in life. Still a little bit of burden, yeah, because you have to have your bow and look after it, but not so much. And then you are content with that. So this is what I would also recommend everyone to be. Be content with whatever you have in life, yeah? Don't always strive for something more. What we have, as long as you have enough to eat, you have a nice shelter, you have a place to stay, you have the basics in life, that is good enough to kind of, be able to live properly. Yeah? And if you're happy with that, if you're not striving for everything else, contentment starts to settle in your life. You start to become more content with your life. Your partner arrived, good enough, yeah? Not perfect, but good enough. Yeah? And then you become content with your partner. And that is a very beautiful way of looking at existence, because it means the mind starts to settle down. And you're not always looking for the future, not always looking at goals, not always looking at results, but instead looking at the process. Contentment is being with the process, not looking to the future, the goals all the time. That's a great way of overcoming craving, yeah? Content, good enough. Goodness is good enough. Okay, and then you can kind of chill, and you can relax, and you can enjoy that. So, yes?
No, there are sometimes you feel that it's good enough for you, you're content with it, but other people are pushing you to get results. You know, like your work, your family members, okay, when are you going to get married, when are you going to have children, how's the result, how are the results going up, things like that. So you get pushed.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true, and sometimes that is certainly the case, and I can see when that is a problem. Sometimes if you are more kind of the more you kind of don't care about that job really, the more time you're happy you are about it. Even if you're tired, you know, you kind of shrug your shoulders, yeah, I don't really care about it. But, and this is one of the nice things that I just mentioned before, one of the, it's actually one of the previous members of the BGF, so, and she became a nun in Perth. I don't know if you know her, yeah, some of you won't know her. Yeah. And she's very, very, very nice, very, very nice person, and a very good nun and all these things. And she had a very good job at Merck, American drug company, and she was kind of a local representative where she was running some training programs for people and stuff. And then finally she got fired. She was so happy when she got fired for me. It's such a good thing, one of the best things that happened in her life. But because it meant that from now on she could dedicate her life fully to Dhamma. Yeah. She could let go of all that thing. So. She was so pleased. But of course, she was very, really into Dhamma practice, yeah? And then she ended up becoming a nun as a consequence. And her husband is now a monk at Bodhidharma Monastery, yeah? He's both kind of alumni of BGF. So sometimes it's strange, yeah? We are afraid of getting fired, but then when you eventually get fired, actually, it opens up all kinds of other possibilities that you never had before. This is kind of the nice thing about it. So the less concerned you are about those worldly things, so the more it opens up other possibilities and other avenues in your life. So the boss is demanding, so you do your best, right? But because you don't really have so much craving for it, you just do it in what is natural pace for you. And if other people aren't pleased with that, well, it's their problem, yeah? If they get fired, you shrug your shoulders, okay, that's life. But you can't allow yourself to be too much pushed around by the world around you. Because if you do, you are always going to handle that. Your own life is never really going to be as satisfying as you think it is. So in the end, you say, oh, this is my way of working, this is the way I have to do things. But if I, so be it. Usually, if you are easygoing and you have a good heart and do the right thing, people will often respect what you do. If they don't, it's their problem again. So that's what I'm thinking about. But my family, I have been pressured to get married and having children, all these kind of things. But again, you just have to say, yes, hello, this is my life. You know, when I'm ready, I will do whatever is right when I'm ready, whatever that is. In the end, your family is going to have to accept that. They accept it really coming mind. That's much worse, yeah? That's far worse. They didn't accept that eventually. It took a long time, but eventually they accepted that. I think that in the end, they will probably come around to that. That's just my guess. Don't allow yourself to be pushed around. If you allow yourself to be pushed around and you do things because other people say so, this is a recipe for getting depressed, yeah? Because it makes you feel that you are not really in charge of your own life. External forces are always controlling you. You're not in charge of it. And that is going to, ultimately, is going to make you not feel very happy about yourself. Don't be afraid of standing your own ground a little bit. If they say something really valuable, yeah? Like, you know, can you help me? Or something. Of course, in that case, you're very happy to help out, yeah? Because it's actually a nice thing to do to be able to help others. But if they try to control your life, and this is where you have the life to say, no, this is my life, I want to do it this way. As long as you do it with kindness and compassion in a good way, that is all. I think that is generally the right approach in life. Don't allow yourself to push around too much. Yes, sir.
The extreme existential pleasure of kidney cold and addiction, but I used to work with a few athletes, and every time I work with them, I feel like an enormous amount of suffering because they're aware of the problem, but the important thing is they know how detrimental it is, but they just don't know how to get out of the problem.
Yeah.
For example, one was addicted to smoking. Like, you know, smoking is really bad at his health, but his urge makes him feel so much wanting to smoke, or not even know what is bad.
Yeah.
And then sometimes people, you know, we have sponsor a place to use the headcut to put things down.
Yeah.
So maybe suggest some way to solve the problem.
Yeah. No, it's true. Addiction can be many kinds, for the video again, how you deal with addiction in life, because addiction can be very strong, like addiction to smoking, for example, how you deal with that. And smoking, cigarettes is a very, very powerful addiction. I've never smoked, I don't really know, but I know people who have smoked, and it's very, very strong. And they say that it's a bit like heroin. Heroin use them as more than a lot of people say, why? That's how strong the addiction is. Of course, heroin is much more destructive, but the type of addiction is a similar effect. So, very hard to let go of that. And the first thing is to always to make sure. First thing is to, people have to want to let go of the addiction. Yeah, that's the first thing. So you have to talk to them, you have to explain to them that it is possible, that it is dangerous. The more they understand that it is a problem, the more willingness they will have to let go of the thing. That is really the first thing. Yeah. And once the will is enough, once you have enough will to let go, usually you are able to let go of that. That is the most important thing. But later on, what you also have to do, you have to not only tell them the danger of this, but you have to give them an alternative in mind, something else that can fulfill those things. It is just like the sensual pleasure. Sensual pleasure can also be an addiction. Actually, it is an addiction. We're all addicted to sensual pleasure to some extent, yeah? Otherwise, life becomes meaningless. Without pleasure, life is pointless. Life is about having pleasure of some kind. So you have to give people an alternative. And the alternative, of course, in Buddhism is the spiritual happiness. That is why it is so important to build up the spiritual happiness, because it gives you an alternative. And the same thing for your friend, the smoker, maybe find some other happiness in life, something else that is meaningful. Something maybe a Buddhist teaching, practice in the Dhamma in the right way. Make him or her find a kind of nice partner in life who doesn't smoke. And who says, I will leave you if you don't smoke. No, that is being too harsh. But you know, somebody has influence over them, yeah? So can actually guide them in the right direction. And once you have an alternative, and you have the motivation to quit because you know how dangerous it is, I think those two things are probably the most important things that allow you to quit eventually. And then you also, another thing which is interesting, and that is that to understand the weakness of human willpower. Human willpower is very, very weak. And the people who are successful in life with kind of avoiding temptation, the reason they are successful is not because they have strong willpower. The reason they are successful is because they know they have to use strategies to avoid those things. And there was one very good example. That was an example of someone had a kind of bakery or something with some very delicious cakes and cookies and things in the window of this bakery. And then they had all these people walk past, yeah? And they were all kind of a little bit hungry, so they looked at it, wow, that looks really tempting, yeah? But they said, you should try to kind of, you know, that they were trying to avoid, they were on the diet or something like that, you should try to avoid, I don't remember exactly how it was set up, but the question was, who is it that has the willpower to walk past without actually, it was for free or something like that, yeah? You just had to walk in and kind of get the free cookie. Who had the willpower to walk past and who did not? Who ended up walking in and accepted the cookie and who actually just walked past? And the people, it had nothing to do with willpower at all. It had to do with the strategy that you used when you walked past. Those people who understood that their willpower is weak, they didn't even look in the window. Yeah? They knew that once I look in the window, I will be hooked on this. But those other people, looking a little bit harder to look, I'm just going to look, and before you know it, bang, you are trapped, and you can't actually get out of it anymore. So understanding the limitations of your own willpower, understanding kind of how weak human willpower is, helps you to find other strategies so that you avoid things. You make sure that you're far away from those things that can actually hurt you. So your friend, if cigarettes are too easy to get, he will smoke. He should make it difficult to get access to cigarettes, yeah? Put yourself in a position, go to a monastery, stay in a monastery for a month, yeah? And determine, I will stay here for a few months. Make sure there's actually no cigarettes in that monastery, yeah? And maybe what should you do so that there's no escape, there's no shops nearby, nothing like that. And then, okay, I'll stay in the room. Make sure he has enough distractions, because we need distractions when addiction is very strong. And this kind of stuff. So you put in place the right strategy, and then often it works out. Okay, so. Yeah, enough? Yeah? Nobody wants to say anything? Okay, so let's stop there and have a nice lunch. I will see you next time again. See you from the conference.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.